The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's podcast, we pick apart Google's new social network and ask whether it's a Facebook killer. We analyze what it means when a country can extradite a web user for breaking their rules in another part of the world. And we find out the latest in the business dealings of Apple, Facebook, and RIM. Joining me in the studio this week is Charles Arthur and Jemima Kish. Hello and welcome to the studio.
Hello.
Jemima, hello, Charles, yes. Sorry, I interrupted you there. Jemima, you're a bit of a surprise guest because you've been away for the past couple of weeks.
Yes, so I went to Glastonbury and then decontaminated afterwards. Now safely returned.
Thank goodness for that. We do have you in a special section that is, you know, surrounded by a decontamination. You can barely hear her.
Yeah.
Barely. So what technology did you use when you were at Glastonbury?
Well, I thought, you know, I'd keep it simple and just take my phone. I realised I'm probably the only person in the world using a Windows phone, but I'd stuck with it. Beautiful screen, overall a fairly good experience. And I really do love that Metro UI. But there is a problem with this phone, which is the HTC HD7. The power button keeps jamming, which means to wake up the phone, I have to take the battery out. And that meant that the first day I got to Glastonbury, with a full battery, the phone was out of power by about 5 or 6 o'clock that night. Meanwhile, all my fellow festival goers, the people in my group anyway, all had iPhones. I think they charged them once for a sort of couple of hours in the orange tent, and they lasted right through to the end of Monday. It was quite embarrassing.
Wow, because most people complain about the iPhones. Battery power.
No, but if you turn the screen brightness down, and if you turn data off, and don't check your emails too much, and definitely don't use GPS, it's actually pretty good.
They should have a sort of festival setting, shouldn't
yes,
they?
Yes, festival setting. That's
like airplane
definitely
mode and festival mode.
Yes, with automatic retrieval if you drop it in the long drops,
that kind of thing. Hideous. And Charles, you've been doing your bit for pop culture. You've been watching the ongoing debate in the hacker community, which we've covered for the past couple of weeks. What's going on in the Lulzsec debacle?
Lulzsec, who sort of said that they disbanded and who don't seem to be getting together much in IRC, have sort of, some of them have reabsorbed back into the Anonymous collective. But Anonymous itself, as a result, is sort of undergoing weird sort of convulsions, so that there are bits of Anonymous which are doing things like hacking Justin Bieber's site. And, there's a real feeling that that they need to get some sort of direction, perhaps, and some clearer idea of what's going on, because it's not quite sensible for all these things to come under the umbrella of Anonymous, because, we're Legion, we're completely confused about what our direction is. It doesn't sort of come over as a slogan.
But this is also the organization, the group, that, you know, a few years ago was hacking Scientology. So it doesn't really seem that they've necessarily had a solid manifesto the entire time anyway. Must they have some kind of overarching organization, some kind of overarching mantra?
Well, look, I've never thought of Justin Bieber really as oppressing the peoples, whereas you could sort of see that if they were trying to do things involving the Chinese government's computers, that might sort of come under the umbrella of, you know, ending oppression more effectively.
Well, you've also been speaking with handheld device makers Arcos, whose Android and Windows tablets aim to upset Apple's cart. And we'll be hearing about that later in the program. All this and more in this edition of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. First in this week's news, Google launched Google Plus, its new social networking service that seems in many ways to replicate features of Facebook, but it adds new functionality that early adopters are celebrating. Charles, what is Google Plus?
Google describes it as the smallest increment you can make to Google, which is, I think, entirely untrue. It's basically a whole social networking system built within the sort of confines of Google users, that is Gmail users, though not so far the corporate apps users, who I suspect actually are the ones who benefit from it most. It looks in appearance very like FriendFeed. So it has, and FriendFeed, which is incorporated into Facebook now, it has things called circles, which are sort of circles of friends. So you could have your friends, your acquaintances, your work friends, people you've heard from once who you need to contact about your volleyball or something. And the idea is that if you want to put out a message, you can sort of type it in a little box, which is up there, and you can say, okay, send it to these circles of interest. So you can send it to everyone, or you can send it just to your work friends, or just your family, your friends, just your volleyball people, and only they, in theory, will see it. And there's a sort of idea that only they will be able to pass it on to others. Although I was asking this morning, and it seems that these things can go further unless you restrict them. But even so, there's nothing to stop people just copying and pasting stuff. There's also a thing called Hangout, which is a sort of video chat, up to 10 video chats at a time. The idea is that you'd be able to sort of go there and say, hey, anyone want to have a talk about something. Again, it's the sort of thing you could see being useful for corporate users where they wanted to have sort of a impromptu conference call. And there's also a thing called Sparks, which is meant to be areas of interest to you, where I think the idea is it's sort of like a news feed of things that will be, you know, that you'd find interesting. I suspect they want to feed it off Google News, but to me it's just rubbish at the moment, to be honest. It may be in the very early stages, but you know, if you're saying that something is about, you know, rock climbing, which was, you know, one of the things I looked at, it was sort of a few sites that tell you about rock climbing. I was thinking, that's not news at all. That's nothing.
It's interesting, given their sort of entire strategy, looking at gathering as much data as possible so that they can deliver to you something that is most relevant to you when you do your search, or, you know, in this thing like Sparks, butt you up against interesting information. But it's another social network that, if you're already invested in existing social networks, it's actually quite a lot of work. You've got to import your friends. You've got to convert your friends, import your friends, import all of your links, import... Yeah. Yes, I like going to stationary superstores because the possibility of getting rid of all of my filing systems and starting from scratch is appealing. But do I really want to do that with a social network? Do I want to start from scratch all over again? Is this something that that actually is worth enough to leave Facebook and to get all of my friends to come over, or to leave Twitter and get all my friends to come over? Jemima?
I think there's something inherently different about what Google is trying to do with Google Plus than what they're used to doing with their search results, which is where they want you to come in and go out as quickly as possible, and they're trying to reduce that time by milliseconds. So the challenge they've set themselves is something completely different to that, which is they want you to dwell in this site and nurture it and curate these circles of people and curate these hangouts. And they're just not very good at doing it, dare I say it.
That also sounds slightly AOL-y. You know, it sounds like, come here, stay in here.
It's data-centric. This is the thing. When you go into Facebook, the thing that pulls you in is seeing pictures of your friends and things they've said, and that's the most visible thing on the site. When you go into Google+, you're confronted with basically lots of options and ways to organise information, and it's just not very compelling. I know it's early days and they will refine it, but... it's just too complicated. It's just far too complicated.
My reaction as well is that I go in and I look at it, and you know, not everyone has got invites yet, so obviously I accept that not everyone will be able to see this. But my experience at the moment is I go in and look at it, and I think, who is this person who's posted this really quite random thing, which is very long and boring to read? I don't really feel like reading it, actually. Yeah. Whereas the comparison with Twitter is that you go to Twitter and you have chosen who you're going to follow, rather like on Facebook. You have chosen who you're going to friend. And the difference there is you very much get to choose who do you hear from. Whereas my feeling is that on Google+, it's longer. It's sort of Facebook length. You know, people can just witter on, which I think, you know, the fact that you have to be brief has always been Twitter's strength. And you're not quite sure why is it this person? You know, I've sort of been in touch with them perhaps once at a time, or maybe they've invited me to, why, you know? And there's so much there, you're never going to get through it.
There's also a real pretense there, though, where I found when I was sort of dragging people into circles and looking at stuff that, Why is Google making me do all this? They know who I talk to online. They know what I search for. They know who my contacts are. And I've logged in with a Google address. Why are they pretending that I need to go and re-establish all these contacts within that interface? It's just rubbish.
That's
it's,
actually it's, because they're worried about the privacy aspect. Having screwed it up so badly with Buzz, where they showed everyone to everyone, on this one, they could have done this the same. They could have done it and sort of said, oh, yeah, this is your close friend because you communicate with them a lot. This is a distant friend because you don't talk to them much at all.
What's interesting is that your criticisms are not necessarily about the fact that it's not connecting you with the right people, because that could be solved by converting your friends and bringing them over. It sounds to me that there are some fundamental things that we will either have to get used to or they will adapt and change. Is that, do you think that that's
the case? It's interface, and it would be much more convincing if there was a much easier way to import friends. I think there is actually a Chrome extension for Facebook friends. But also if it was, if it wasn't a destination you went to, if it was something that was just a layer on top of places that you went to where you used Google. So it was where you went rather than you having to go there.
It would be, it would be interesting to look at how people were talking when Facebook was coming up and MySpace was the dominant one. You know, were people saying, yeah, but the thing about Facebook is, you know, why would you go there? But actually thinking about it, my perception is that every social network that's been successful, that's had explosive growth, has had a particular reason, a particular thing that it did really well. So with Facebook, what it did really well, and the thing that made it special and demanding, was that it was people within these universities in the States, and they all got into it, and once there was demand, once there was enough demand, pent-up demand in a new place, then they would unleash it there. With Twitter, it was a very, it began with a small core of developers who were all talking to each other about things, and they got into it in a big way, and then it sort of exploded.
That helped though because it was, it's Twitter's unique selling point is still events. It's still, you know, the notion of everybody's coming together and tweeting about a particular thing. That's really how it exploded.
The interactive helpfulness. Yeah. You know, Bebo again was a sort of teen thing, and I think that that actually Dave Weiner said it very well. He said big companies can't do revolutions because that's not what big companies are about.
Speaking of big companies and Google doing revolutions, Google Plus appears to have already been blocked in China. Why is this?
The Chinese government doesn't like Google.com. It doesn't let any sort of unfiltered Google.com content go straight through to China. And really what seems to have happened is that it's not making any exception here. It's basically blocking the plus.google.com subdomain as well.
And the other question, the final question that I have about this is, as you said, Jemima, at the moment, it's quite a small group of people who are in there. When do they expect to open this out to the larger public?
I asked Google how many people were on the test and how long it would go on for. All that they said was that they were very pleased with the results so far, and that they have enough testers involved to provide comprehensive real-world data about how people first use the product.
So we have no idea.
we should say as well, there has been an email scam that Sophos picked up, just so that everyone is aware, you might get an email that looks like an invite to Google Plus, and actually it will just take you to some dodgy Viagra site. So just a word of caution there.
You mentioned, Charles, an interesting one interesting aspect of Google Plus is its video conferencing. Mm. Facebook, we're expecting them to announce tomorrow a partnership, a relationship with Skype. What do we know about that?
Mark Zuckerberg, who I think was trying to take some of the blaze of glory away from Google Plus, which, you know, people really are very interested by, said we're going to have something awesome next week. And all the signs are that it is going to be a Skype hookup, whereby you'll be able to do video chat or something. Rather, is at the moment you can do text chat. And I think voice chat, or is that not on Facebook yet? No voice chat. Okay. So the expectation is that that'll come in as well.
Will this actually earn Skype some money, do you think? Do you think they're going to try and monetize this in any way?
It'll be interesting to see which way the money flows, whether the money will flow between Skype from Facebook to Skype, which is now owned by Microsoft, or whether this is Microsoft saying to Facebook, hey, you guys, it'd be really nice if you could get our names everywhere.
I think this is really interesting timing as well, because I think this is going to be massive, because Facebook does have very good skills at taking a new technology and encouraging people to use it. They have a very mainstream user base. And as we've seen with FaceTime on phones and Skype really becoming enormously mainstream, people are losing that sort of inhibition about using video. I think it's going to be absolutely massive.
Well, retreating back into Google News, the search giant threw its hat into the bidding ring for a raft of 6,000 patents that were released when the technology company Nortel Networks went bust earlier this year. Apple, Microsoft, and BlackBerry makers RIM were competing with Google for the valuable intellectual property, although Google didn't really seem to be taking the affair very seriously. Analysts quickly realized that the money that they were bidding, the actual numerics, were mathematical in-jokes. Oh, to have money that could allow you to do mathematical in-jokes. Charles, what kinds of figures are we talking about here?
Well, at one point they bid $3.14159 billion.
Billion. I know what that is.
And at another point earlier in the auction, they bid $1.90216054 billion, which is Brun's constant, which is the number that you get if you add the reciprocals of the odd twin primes. You knew this already.
I knew this already.
And there's 2.61497128 billion, which is, of course, is the Meissel-Mertens constant, which I think we're also familiar with.
Oh, very. That's old hat.
I think you did that in GCSE maths.
I mean, this is hilarious, and well done, Google, for having so much money that they can just throw these figures around. But really, Charles, this was a serious issue. They didn't win. Google didn't win in the end. And so what are the implications for the company?
They didn't win because they didn't go as high as the consortium that they were up against. Google had actually shown interest in it back in April when they put in a bid of $900 million.
Which isn't hilarious.
I don't think they did it as... I don't think it was sort of $93 million, you know, like the distance to the sun. But anyway, they bid for these patents, which for all sorts of communications things, especially things like long-term evolution, also known as 4G, which is next generation communications for smartphones. But at this point, other people came in. So there was Apple came in, Microsoft came in, RIM came in, Intel came in. It turned into a really big bidding war. And when some of the companies dropped out, they then started to form consortia with the other ones. So it ended up that there was Intel and Google on one side, and there was Apple and Microsoft. Microsoft believed to be representing Nokia as well. And RIM and a couple of others on the other. So in the end, the bigger consortium just had more money. Apple has got pots of money. So Apple seems to have walked away. According to Robert Crinsley, no one else has actually given any numbers on this or any details of quite who's got what. But Crinsley says that it breaks down this. Microsoft and Sony is one of the consortium partners, put up $1 billion. RIM and Ericsson, who are also in the consortium, put up $1.1 billion. Ericsson getting a fully paid-up license to the portfolio, while RIM gets a paid-up license, possibly it's able to take some of the operating losses from Nortel, because they're both Canadian, and use it against tax. And Apple put up $2 billion for outright ownership of the long-term evolution, the 4G patents, as well as some others which might affect Android. So, at the end of the day, Google loses out, but then again, it's still got the $4.5 billion that it didn't spend on it. So they can, you know, if it does all come down to lawsuits and patents and payments and royalties and licenses, then that's money that they still have to use. It would have been good for Google to get these, and Florian Mueller, who's an analyst who looks at what's going on with the whole patent wars, thinks that it was quite significant that Google didn't get this, that it is going to have an effect on Android and the payments that will have to be made by Android licensees on these things. That if Google had won this, then it would have had a much better patent portfolio to fight against lawsuits with.
This does really put Google on the back foot in terms of Android, though, doesn't it? I mean, legally, these patents are enormously useful defence, and as you wrote, they're a very young company and they don't have many patents in the bank to defend themselves. So could this put Android at more risk legally?
Well, it does mean that that when people like Oracle, when Apple, when Nokia, when Microsoft especially comes after Android handset makers, then Google can't sort of stand up on their side and say, well, you know, we've got these patents, so if you want to, you know, if you want us to license your patents, you have to license ours in return. So that it turns out to be a zero-sum game. So, for example, at the moment, it's already the case that HTC is paying Microsoft an estimated $5 per handset, per Android handset that it sells. Microsoft is doing better money out of Android than it is out of Windows Phone at the moment.
Next up, a development in international law. The official U.S. Anti-Piracy Enforcement Organization, ICE, is targeting overseas website owners for breaking their copyright laws, that's the U.S. copyright laws, despite the servers being physically located outside U.S. territories. So if a website ends in .com or .net, which are U.S.-based identifiers, kind of like .co.uk indicates a British-based registration, and this .com or .net is implicated in copyright-infringing acts, it can be sued, according to ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Charles, what's the story here? This is fascinating. This is potentially terrifying as well. I mean, who's being sued on what grounds?
Well, this all comes out of the case of Richard O'Dwyer, who's a 23-year-old British student who actually faces extradition under this this claim by the ICE because he ran a site called TVShack.net, which had links to unlicensed streams of films and TV shows. And the argument the ICE is using is that, okay, he's British, okay, he lives in Britain, okay, the servers were not located in the US, but because he used .net as the registration, therefore it comes under VeriSign, which has links to the US government historically, and because it's a US registration, therefore they can extradite it.
So VeriSign is it's a US organization, it's a US company that owns... has ownership of .net and .com?
That historically has links back to the .com, .net registrations. It's a sort of, you know, it used to be the only one that gave registrations when the internet was young, and there were links to the US government, but that's sort of all in the distant past now.
Now, are they just making an example of this kid? There are other organizations, like, for example, the Pirate Bay, which is actually a .org. I don't know if .org falls under this potential extradition, the extent of their purview that ICE is going to start, you know, reaching out and targeting people. PirateBay.org is based in, you know, not in the US. They could potentially pull them up on this as well. Why have they chosen this kid?
Because they have a better extradition treaty with Britain than they would do with Sweden. Possibly because they sort of thought of this as a possible wrinkle in international law. I mean, I think it's all still to be played for. You know, I think that the evidence that it's a US-based registration and therefore you have broken US law and therefore you can be extradited to the US feels very weak. But, you know, we've seen bizarre extraditions before.
Well, it also feels slightly terrifying, especially looking at, you know, how this potentially rolls out. ICANN is now releasing its domain registration for a variety of countries. What if, for example, a culturally sensitive piece of, you know, technology or content is on somebody else's patch, can that company then come along and say, well, you don't reside in this country and the servers don't reside in this country, but just because it's an interesting word that's been formed out of the dot whatever, the dot suffix, we don't like the content, you need to take that down. I mean, is this
well,
what
I think
we're,
it's more than,
we may
more
see
than taking it
future?
Down, it's more whether they'd sort of look to extradite and take control. Yeah, it is very worrying, but I think as much as anything, it's a big scare tactic, but I suspect it works.
This is another high-profile example of an extradition based upon a British individual being requested to go to the United States and to be put in front of their court of law. Do we now need to come up with a sort of new international policy mechanisms, given that we're dealing with an international technology? Is this something that's going to start rolling over and over? Are we going to see more and more of these types of things?
This is the framework for that international regulation, I suppose, if there is any. We'll start having legal precedents, and that will form the basis of any kind of framework that we have. But I think we need a far more overarching, intelligent basis for all these kind of issues. And these are just going to keep coming up again and again.
And potentially, can you envisage more more places like Sealand, which was an outpost that didn't have any national jurisdiction, which effectively allowed a lot of porn and gambling servers offshore. Can we imagine that there will be non-national sort of domain areas? And then what are the implications? Will we ultimately stop being countries and start being
pirate?
I can't imagine anywhere like Sealand. It's unique.
It certainly is. And I hope one of these days we'll be doing a podcast from there, but that's just in the fantasy pile.
Okay, you're rowing the boat then.
It's fine. No, I've been there. So you can head to guardian.co.uk/technology for the latest on all this week's news and more. For many, it feels like the Apple iPad has the tablet market sewn up. The sleek design has already become an icon. But other operating systems are available, and hardware manufacturer Arcos has a strong presence in the Android and increasingly the Windows 7 market. Charles, you spoke with their president, Henri Coras. What happened? What went on?
They were here to launch a range of new tablets that they've come up with, including 3G functionality, which plugs in. Arcos has always been interesting because they've not gone down the phone route. They've generally just done they used to be an MP3 players in a big way, and they've moved into the tablet market. They had the sort of small iPod Touch style things a few years ago, and they do pretty well. Although one tends not to notice them, they're not a sort of big splash. But in France, they're quite popular. And so I asked Henri Coras about their background in manufacturing tablets.
We were the first to enter this market in 2009. I believe that we made the first Android tablets. That was in September 2009, and the iPad came in mid-2010. And also in 2009, we made the first Windows-based tablet. So we were quite ahead of the crowd. And we sold 1 million tablets until the end of 2010, so not bad. So today the market is very good for us, and you're right. I mean, the market is getting crowded, but we're doing very well in this market. We have quite some original solutions, and our price band, our prices, are also significantly lower than the iPad, whereas all the newcomers tend to make what I call an iPad killer. And therefore, they make a product facing the iPad at about the same price. And this is not where we are. So we are the first one to bring ARM Cortex dual core A9 at 1.5 gigahertz. Also, I explained that we have a better multimedia. Our products, they run 1080p, H.264, high profile, and this is very important because this is basically what videos that you can find on the internet and elsewhere are today, because they are encoded for PCs, and they are all 1080p H.264 high profile, and the other tablets cannot play that.
So do you think then that the main use for tablets is for watching films, for watching media in this way, that it's not for production of content? Or is that just Android tablets where you think that?
No, I think it's both. But multimedia, video, music is very important. And it's very important to be able to play what's available out there on the internet. We also have a very high capacity 250 gigabyte tablets.
This is one which has got a hard drive, which seems like a surprisingly retrograde step. I mean, for example, the Apple moved from having, originally with the iPod, they had a 5 gigabyte iPod in 2001, then they moved on to being all flash throughout pretty much all of their range. And yet you've gone for a tablet which has got a moving hard drive, which surely has the risk that if you drop it, you destroy the hard drive.
Yes, of course, you're right in saying that. I mean, we use a large memory buffer, 4 gigabyte, in order to power on and power off the hard drive as quickly as we can. And this technology there of handling hard drive, this is something very special that we've developed for years, and it works very well. And actually, the price of a 250-gigabyte tablet today is about the same price as a 32-gigabyte for flash. So we do both. And hard disk and mobility work. I mean, they work for the iPod. They work for the iPod. They work for Apple, and they also work for us. There's no problem there.
Isn't the trend towards having more content in the cloud? The Google stores data in the cloud. Apple is doing it with iCloud. Microsoft is offering it with SkyDrive. Amazon with its Music MP3 service, and that people stream that data out of there, so they don't have to have a lot of storage locally. Do you think that those ideas of streaming from the cloud, are they just too advanced? Do you think people really want more data locally?
No, I mean, I think you're right. You're right. I mean, the cloud is there, but you're not always connected. And playing a high-def movie from the cloud is difficult unless you have a wideband connection, which is not always the case. And what we see, what we've seen for many years, is that there is a category of people looking for capacity. It's the same for PCs. And we always see that we sell almost about 50% hard drive and 50% flash. So it's a question of choice, of taste, and it's a question for the end user knowing what they want to do with the tablet.
How do you think, then, that the market is going to break down? At the moment, the iPad, certainly in the Western world, has the majority share of the tablet market, and Android versions have a smaller share. How do you think that's going to move in the next few years, say?
Well, in the next few years, I don't know, but today I know that certainly the iPad dominates the market. And as I said earlier, all the newcomers, at least the big newcomers, the big brands, they tend to be there at about the same price band. And I think it's going to be difficult for them because I've been doing that for 10 years in a way, being in the same product category. And I know that it's difficult to be face-to-face with Apple. And that's why we've designed products which are differentiated technically, and they end up being 30 to 40% cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I think that tablets are bound to be cheaper than where they are today, £400 or £500. And I think this is what we are going to see in the near future, tablets going down to the £200 area.
That was Henri Corras from tablet manufacturers Arcos. For more information, visit arcos.com. That's it for this week's podcast. Many thanks, Charles, and also thank you, Jemima. You can find links to all the stories we discussed today on guardian.co.uk/techweekly, and you can stay updated with us throughout the week on Twitter at GuardianTW. The producer this week was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Kratosky, and we will be back next Tuesday. See you then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.